Good afternoon, or good morning, maybe. Good morning, good morning, good morning. It is a Getaway Friday, October the 20th, 2017. Getting close to Halloween. 11:13 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And today we're going to have a fun hour. We were going to do this last week, but due to circumstances beyond our control, that did not happen. But today, we are so lucky to get a chance to talk with a man who I have enjoyed listening to for quite a long time. We've had some sad losses in the world of professional wrestling in the last month. Bobby Heenan, Lance Russell, two of the greats, and so many more gone over the last few years. And a gentleman who knew all of these people, or most of them, through his work in World Championship Wrestling, which was the Ted Turner-owned and operated organization of the 1980s and 1990s and into the 2000s. He was a great broadcaster there, worked with a lot of great people, Dusty Rhodes, Larry Zbysko, the whole bunch. So glad to welcome to these microphones, Chris Cruz. Chris, how are you?
Hey, great to be here.
Good to talk with you. Chris, how did you get into broadcasting?
I was a kid, and my godfather and first cousin was the local anchor up in Portland, Maine, and come from a family of reporters. I didn't want to do print reporting, although I wish I had, at least at the start. And I just, you know, as a kid, I had a very high voice up until puberty. People would call me ma'am when I answered the telephone. And then when I hit 13, my voice just deepened almost like it is now. And I'm 58 now. And, you know, people kept saying you should go into radio, you should go into radio. And so I did a little bit of radio in my mid to late teens, believe it or not. I phoned in news tips to stations. Back then in the 70s, stations were required to do news by the FCC, local news. And then I went into the Army and became an Army broadcaster and got out, went back to Portland, Maine, and, you know, went to a local station like so many of us do, and then worked my way up to the network level.
What makes a good broadcaster?
I think the ability to vamp, you know, to fill time, the ability to write clearly. I write columns for the Radio and Television Digital News Association on bad news writing. You know, I give examples of bad news writing. And the tough thing, I think, is to be authoritative and yet friendly and accessible. And that's just not easy to do. You know, certainly a willingness to listen. And more in my work at the Voice of America, in particular during the week, the ability to bring on real voices, you know, like I said, I'm 58, I was born in 1959, and in all those years, you know, growing up, there was kind of sort of the Ronnie radio, deep voice, middle-aged man on the radio, and that, I think, with the work of others, and I'm certainly pushing it, has led to the real voices movement, and you hear that on NPR, that, you know, people who may not have a deep voice and may not be a middle-aged white male, are nonetheless still on the radio and certainly on television. So I think that's kind of sort of what makes a great broadcaster.
You know, Chris, something that always fascinates me working in the radio business is the lack of women. And it's yeah. always been that way. Men have always outnumbered women in radio, not in television anymore,
yeah.
but it's never happened in radio. Why do you think that is?
Good question. I mean, I had a meeting with the VOA director yesterday. I'm a steward at the union, and we have monthly meetings with her, and we were talking about that. So during the week, I'm a VOA. I'm a news anchor. We spread news in English throughout the world, and generally, I'd say 90 to 95% of the hourly newscasts are anchored by men, and yet there are a lot of women in the building. And so I think what we've got to do is to reach out to them. Certainly on the network level, when I anchor at Westwood One News, you know, I anchor sometimes during the week and every Saturday and Sunday morning. And we do have a large number of female anchors. And I think that that's absolutely essential. I think it's essential in some areas where there are ethnic groups to have people even with accents on the air, to bring people up from the very groups that you're trying to reach. So if you're trying to reach a diverse audience, to have a middle-aged white man with a deep voice on may not be the best choice.
Something that's always fascinated me, being in Ohio, is that in the history of broadcasting in Ohio, whether it be radio or television, each area in Ohio had a woman that stood out in the 20th century. Here in Marion, we had Madge Cooper. Columbus had Sally Flowers. Dorothy Fulltime was up in Cleveland. Ruth Lyons was down in Cincinnati. But they were almost kind of a novelty. They were the most popular people in the state. A matter of fact, I don't even remember the men who would have been behind them at the time, but they were the only ones in their area. It was different.
Yeah, I think it's as well, you know, when you look in management, I think we've done a good job of it at VOA, and I know that radio is trying. I mean, I was in the mortgage business for the longest time, and we had a devil of a time, you know, promoting women and promoting minorities, even getting them into the business. Because, you know, if women and minorities are on the outside looking in and what they see inside is not them, then they may move on to an industry that seems more open and accessible. But, you know, especially in broadcasting, where we are trying to reach a diverse audience, for the most part, I mean, certainly there remain pockets of America that are, you know, whether they're farm stations, whether they're rural stations, where the audience may be mostly white. But then there are some stations where the audience may be mostly black and mostly Hispanic. So I think, you know, with narrow casting as opposed to broadcasting, you can serve that audience. And as we've seen on Sirius XM radio, you know, they've got all these channels, much like cable television channels, where you can super serve your audience. So I think in broadcasting, you know, you've literally got to broadly cast your net and try to bring in as many people as possible. And then there are some, you know, for instance, liberal or conservative talk radio that is trying to serve a very narrow niche, you know, getting rich in the niche of your audience.
Another thing that has fascinated me about radio is age. Now, television, they can see you. They kind of can guess your age. But I've heard people say it has to be younger on air. You have to get younger. Nobody gets on the air and says, I'm 85 years old. Does age really matter on the radio?
Well, it's interesting. I think what you talk about on the radio, and certainly the demographic that you and your advertisers are trying to reach, is important. You know, can you fake it? Can you be 58 and read teen magazines? I mean, I guess you could. You know, I think women have the chance to sound much younger than men do on the radio. You know, but one of the things I remember, you know, as a teenager, you know, you listen to the local rock or pop station. And teens, you know, they have pretty well-tuned ears. And I think they know, you know, when there's a guy who's 27 who's trying to act 17, and that comes across as inauthentic. So really that's a result of the program director, the PD, trying to find the right people. And it's more and more competitive anymore now in radio than it ever has been. I mean, it's difficult to find good radio news people. It's difficult to find good radio news network people. You know, so many people have gravitated to the internet, to YouTube, to cable television, to satellite radio. So it's quite competitive. And yet radio, I think, is the really, you know, the fabric of so many people's lives. So it makes me cringe when I think that a particular area is not being served by a local radio station.
One thing, an evolution that has happened in the last 10 years, certainly is internet into the radio world. People can now see radio because people want to podcast or videotape themselves or do whatever they do. How has internet changed radio? We've seen how it's changed newspapers. It's almost put the print editions out of business. We've saw how it's changed television. Internet is on television now. All TVs, smart TVs, come equipped with YouTube. How has it changed radio?
Well, I think it's made radio stations more accessible, whether it's through apps or online streaming. And I think it's forced the smaller radio stations to really up their game. So, you know, in the old days, you could, you know, if you traveled a lot, you could see maybe major market television was a little bit, you know, different than the television stations you were in. But now, you know, if you're in Marion, Ohio, somebody is expecting you to be as good, if not better, than somebody who's on in Cincinnati or Fort Lauderdale or Boston. So I think it's forced everybody to really be much more professional, be better sounding. The other challenge, I think, is if somebody is in Marion, Ohio, you know, why should they listen to your station if they can, you know, get stations from, you know, major markets or networks or something? And I think, again, we go back to the super serving is, you know, what can you do that's different from national? And I think that that's really the challenge of local radio is getting down to the granular level, and it's one of the challenges that newspapers have as well. If somebody can get USA Today and the Washington Post and the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Times online, why do they need, you know, a tiny newspaper in your hometown? Well, that tiny newspaper covers your school board, it covers your city council, it covers City Hall. So it's extraordinarily competitive, and in many respects, unfortunately, advertisers, because they're able now to really, again, supersize their audience and to superserve their audience, I should say, and to segment out their audience, especially through Facebook and Twitter, you know, the local outlets have got to find a way to deliver those eyeballs to the advertisers. If not, they're not going to survive.
I think something that the local outlets have had a problem with in the last few years is even though we have the internet, and you would think the world has become bigger, I think it's become smaller, because people go home at night and they read the Washington Post online, they read the New York Times, they watch CNN, they watch Fox News, and they know what's going on nationally. And if it's a slow day in your local community and there is nothing gigantic to talk about, people at home know what's going on with President Trump. They know what's going on nationally, overseas, and some local radio stations want to stay absolutely local when that's very difficult to do in this world.
Well, it requires shoe leather reporting. You know, you've got to be on the ground, and, you know, you've got to pay reporters. Reporting is not cheap. And so my concern is that people know more about the President of the United States than the mayor of their town. And certainly what the President does and the Congress does in terms of the budget and national security has an impact on each and every, you know, one of the 330 million residents of the United States of America. But, you know, you need to know your local tax rates. You need to know, you know, I started as a local reporter. I reported on curb cuts. I reported on mill rates. I reported on development. I reported on zoning. Those are the things that matter on a granular level to you every single day. You know, is this bridge going to be built? Is this road going to turn into a toll road? Are we going to approve, you know, additional development in an area that already has a lot of traffic? So you go to these...
You still there, Chris? Chris, are you there? Hello, Chris. Uh-oh, I think we might have lost him. Hopefully we'll get Chris Cruz back here just momentarily. Not sure what happened there, but we will try to get Chris Cruz back via the telephone so we can continue on with that conversation. So stay there. Don't go anywhere. We're going to be right back, continue the conversation with Chris Cruz and on in the broad world and touch on his wrestling career as well. So stay tuned. We'll be back momentarily.
Everybody's talking about Now with Scott Spears, Monday through Thursday, 12:10 to 2 p.m. right here on WWGH Radio, from legendary comedian Kay Ballard performing the fast food song.
Oh, there's one song that you like. I feel that, you know, fast foods have ruined the world.
Oh.
On the Champs-Élysées, on the Appian Way, there's McDonald's. By the Tomb of King Tut, there's a Chuck Full of Nuts and McDonald's. At La Scala, they sing, buy a big burger, a funk rock, it's go sweet. What's the use? What's the hell? I just heard Bell Webb franchise the wing at the Louvre. You know, I could go on and on and on, but that's it. I love things that are topical and that are kind of true.
to legendary actress and the voice of Ursula from The Little Mermaid, Pat Carroll.
Well, what would we do without gossip, for heaven's sake, Scott? Oh, it's naughty, but it certainly fulfills a certain catty side of all of us. Oh, good Lord. When you think of the gossip sessions you've had with friends over the years, it's wonderful. Yeah. It's like putting your hands in front of a lovely fire. Do anything you want, Scott. You know I enjoy being on your show. Look, well, just let me talking and I keep going.
It's now with Scott Spears, Monday through Thursday, 12:10 to 2 p.m. right here on WWGH Radio 107.1 FM. Streaming live on the internet at www.wwgh1071.com. Join me.
Hey, Scott Spears, back with you here, 20th of October, 2017, 29 minutes past the hour. I believe we've got Chris Cruz back. Chris, are you there? Chris, are you there? We lost Chris again. We are going to continue to work on this. He was back there for a second and then went south again. I wonder what happened there. Now, see, this is one of the things that can happen in live radio. These type of things. Okay. Hang on. We had Chris back. We're going to try to get him back here momentarily. So we will just hold on here for a second and tell you about the Vietnam Veterans of America Chapter 1117 breakfast coming up the last Saturday of the month, 7:30 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. at VFW Post 7201 1614 Marion Marysville Road. This event is open to the public. And I believe we have the connection reestablished with Chris Cruz. Chris, are you there?
Yeah, I called back, and then I heard a recording or something, so I didn't know if it was the bottom of the hour, and I got cut off for news, or what happened.
No, we are good. We can continue on now.
Okay.
Chris, talking about the world of broadcasting here, how did you end up in professional wrestling?
Well, I was a local reporter, a local television reporter in Portland, Maine, at the NBC affiliate, and we covered a lot of what happened at the Cumberland County Civic Center. And I had been a wrestling fan since I was 9, so let me see, I got a damn at 21, so I guess I was in my mid-20s at that point, and I'd been a wrestling fan for going on, 15 years or so. And wrestling used to be at the Civic Center, and this was the mid-80s, and I knew that WrestleMania was happening, and I really kind of wanted to get out of journalism for a while. And I talked to the manager of the local Civic Center. Believe it or not, his name was Jack Nicholson. What a name to have. And he had contact with Vince McMahon, and turns out they needed some public relations help. And they did. And so, you know, it wasn't a permanent job because Vince was not convinced that that his company would survive the first WrestleMania. So at the end of it, a few days after WrestleMania, we all got a $1,000 bonus check and, you know, a thank you. And we all went on our way. But, you know, I had had enough exposure to wrestling that I wanted to get back into it. And then I knew that I wasn't ready to be a play-by-play announcer yet, but I thought I was close. And I didn't think I was ready to be a play-by-play announcer at WWE, but I thought maybe a lower level at WCW. And so I called Jim Herd, got through to him, and did a couple of auditions, and before you know it, I was hosting a show.
And what was Jim Herd like? Everybody has these nasty things to say about Jim Herd. What kind of guy was he?
Well, he was nice to me. I didn't have much contact with him. But he was always nice to me and professional and treated me well. Though I think the problem was that, you know, he was a guy who was in the Turner system and he had a little bit of exposure to wrestling. They needed somebody to run their, their little sliver of business called World Championship Wrestling. And, he wasn't going to say no because he was kind of a floating executive. So he got, plugged in wherever they needed him. And I think the problem was maybe You know, he didn't listen enough to the wrestling people. He thought he could bring his management abilities to wrestling, and it was just such an odd, it's like the circus almost, or like the movie business. It's almost like you have to grow up in it in order to really understand it. And I think probably, and maybe he'd even acknowledge it to this day, he didn't understand it enough and tried to impose his own will on it. And, you know, the wrestling people just didn't like that. They, you know, it's a closed, it was back then, it still is to some extent, but it was back then, you know, extraordinarily a closed community and almost like a religious cult. And if you weren't born and raised in it, you weren't really ever accepted in it.
I want to go back for a second. Did you attend the original WrestleMania?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I was there. I was the director of media and public relations for WrestleMania, the first WrestleMania. So I was there, Madison Square Garden. Oh,
yeah. What was that like in Madison
Square? Well, it was crazy. It was unfocused. It was, you know, I was riding up and down on the freight elevators and back. It was Hogan. It was T. It was Piper. It was Cyndi Lauper. And you just kind of, it was kind of like barely controlled chaos. You know, there was no understanding, except maybe in the mind of Vince and others, that this was the beginning of something. I don't know that when you're ever at the beginning of something extraordinary that you know it, but it was clearly the beginning. And then, yeah, my guess is he was planning WrestleMania 2 from that day on. And I think it just exploded. You know, before then, I traveled a lot with Hogan and T, and, you know, Vince caught a wave. He may have started the wave as well, but he certainly caught it.
WrestleMania 1, if people don't remember, Liberace, the Rockettes, Mr. T, who was on the A-team at that time, Muhammad Ali. That's a great group to market. How did they all come on board with professional wrestling?
Well, that's a good question. I wasn't at that level, but, you know, I think as celebrities who were, you know, always looking for more publicity, you know, they saw this as a vehicle to get them publicity. And that's really what happened is, you know, Ali was on the down, you know, the downside of his career. And, you know, I'm sure Vince, you know, said, we'll write you some big checks. We'll get you on Good Morning America. You know, we'll get you a lot of publicity. And that's what celebrities, after all, are after.
As you said earlier on, this was kind of a make-or-break deal for Vince McMahon and what was then the WWF. Why was there hesitation? How could that have gone wrong? What would have, if it had went the wrong way, what would have been the reason?
Well, he had put out a lot of money and made a lot of promises, and at that time was buying a lot of time on local stations, and was deeply in debt, as far as I know, and was almost completely dependent on the pay-per-view revenue from WrestleMania. So if it had bombed on pay-per-view, he would not have had the income and the money to pay off the debts and would likely have had to declare bankruptcy. At the time, I think his father was still living, and he owed his father hundreds of thousands of dollars for the company, and I think he was paying his father out of the cash flow from the company. So, you know, ultimately, it all worked out, but he, you know, say what you will about Vince McMahon, but he always bets the company. I mean, if he has a vision, he's all in. He's 100% in, jumps in with both feet. And, you know, we saw that he did it with pay-per-view. We saw that he did it with cable when he said goodbye to the syndicated stations. We saw that he is doing it with his network when he said goodbye to a pay-per-view and may even be saying goodbye to cable at some point.
So much went on prior to that first WrestleMania. Hulk Hogan and Mr. T appeared on Saturday Night Live. They were on CBS on Sunday morning shows. Appearances on Johnny Carson. How was that all done from the PR perspective?
Well, you know, it's funny because a lot of times one of the things that you do is you try to, you know, you call stations and you call these places and you try to book them. You know, it's called pitching. But in our case, it wasn't pitching. It was, you know, dealing with incoming. It was catching. And so, you know, it was a matter of scheduling. So, you know, Hogan and T were on Good Morning America. Now, I mean, I wasn't at that level of the public relations shop. But, you know, my sense is that when they were on Good Morning America, GMA called us. We didn't have to call them. And that's when you know you're really in. That's when you know you've really, you know, got this publicity thing going on.
You go down to Atlanta. Now, at that time, Ted Turner has CNN. This is huge in the late early 1990s. TBS is the biggest cable station. TNT is there. What's it like working at Turner?
Well, I had lived in Atlanta before when I was at CNN Headline News. And, I loved Atlanta. But, I knew that it was smaller than the World Wrestling Federation at the time. And at the time, I was still living in Maine. So I was commuting once or twice a week between Maine and Atlanta. And then they changed things so that, we were mostly on the road. And so I would mostly live in Atlanta and then move back to Maine. And then it got to the point where I moved to North Carolina. And I was commuting usually, I think, on Tuesdays to do that.
WCW, what year did you start there?
I was trying to think. I think it was in the late 80s. I was there for 2 years, and I think I was there for 2 years again in the early 90s. I probably should look at my resume or my LinkedIn. I'm not sure.
At that point, is it fun to work there?
Yeah, because for me, I stayed out of the office politics, and I didn't, I wasn't involved with, with the backstage maneuverings and stuff because, in the first place, I'm not good at it, and the second place, I don't like it. So it was the second go-round is when the crowds, especially for the TV tapings, really started to drop off. So you'd go into these mid to small in size and small size southern towns, and 500 people would show up. You'd have to ask them all to sit on one side of the arena. And we had 3 or 4 hours of TV to tape and a lot of squash matches. And that's when you realized that wasn't fun anymore. And there was also the point at which so many of the resources were going to Nitro. And yet we were still doing WCW Saturday Night. We were still doing Pro. We were still doing Worldwide. So it was a pretty, long, painful slide, to go from king to peasant.
One of the first times I think you came to national prominence in WCW was when you replaced Gordon Solie on the Saturday morning show with Dusty Rhodes and Larry Zbyszko. How did it come about that you would replace Gordon?
Well, he was known to not be happy. He and I would do some shows together and, he'd look at some of the format sheets. And it was just his time. He was not, well suited for the format. He was not well suited for the travel anymore. He was a name. And that's the thing about broadcasting is so many broadcasters, much like athletes, they tend to stay on longer than they should. And, it just got to the point that the value that he brought to the show was not sufficient, especially not on Saturday morning. I think he knew it. The management certainly knew it, but, he was much loved and much respected by people like Dusty and others who basically grew up with him on the stick. So it just got to that point, and then all of a sudden I got a call, and they said, I'm on the Saturday morning show with Larry, and bada bing, bada boom, that's it.
It's interesting, this big boom that WCW had. I remember you came in prior to that boom, just after Hulk Hogan had come to the company before Monday Nitro, and there were others like Scott Hudson and Lee Marshall and Mike Tenay who came in after you, Mark Madden, but you never did Nitro or any of those programs. Was there a reason you didn't have a go any further than, I guess, the pro program?
Yeah, I certainly wanted to. I think I probably wasn't well suited to them. I thought my strengths were at Worldwide. I also think as a program host, I wasn't, the best. I think maybe I should have just stuck with play-by-play. There was also, I also had a seriousness about me and maybe, that was better suited to news. And that's, certainly what I'm doing now. And I do international news during the week and then mostly domestic news on the weekends. And I think that's probably what I'm well suited for. The other thing is certainly at Nitro, you had, it was a vehicle for Eric and then later for Tony. And Tony Schiavone, of course, he was a producer and he was in the office all day, every day. and, you know, was known to be reliable and a strong supporter of the company, and I think that that's probably why it happened.
Not to get into financials or anything, but one of the big things in WCW that goes around was paid a lot of money not to do much work. What was your work week like, and were you being paid well?
Yeah, I was after, you know, I was paid a set amount, and then after I did, when Worlds Collide in Los Angeles, Eric doubled the pay so that I would stay, and then I was basically making full-time money for one day a week. You know, I'd fly down on Tuesdays, do a couple of hours, and then come back. So I would leave, you know, Greensboro at 7 in the morning, be back at 4 or 5 in the afternoon. So, no, it could be crazy money. And, you know, you hear these reports of some wrestlers being paid hundreds of thousands of dollars and rarely used. So it was kind of unfortunate, but I guess that's what happens when you're using other people's money. You're not as secure about it, you know?
Want to go through some names here in the last 15 minutes and kind of give me a thumbnail of these great personalities who you got a chance to work with. And we'll start with the gentleman who recently passed away, Lance Russell.
Yeah, I wrote a lot about Lance on Facebook. Just a real gem. I think, you know, that's another challenge that he had into the format of WWE when he was, you know, a Memphis-oriented broadcaster. And so making that leap from local to national was a challenge. I thought he did it. I thought he was great on the air. And it's just, you know, you think these guys never die. But, you know, he's 91 years old, I guess. You know, eventually they go. But it was just really sad. And a person who literally nobody could ever say anything bad about.
Bobby Heenan.
Bobby, again, you know, when I was reading the obituary not too long ago, he was a guy for whom wrestling was very closed. And so he was always cordial to me. I always enjoyed his company. But I was seen by him as an outsider. I respected that perspective and never tried to intimate that I was anything other than a play-by-play guy.
Gordon Sully.
Gordon was, you know, at the back end of his career when I knew him and was unhappy with the situation, but always took it very, very seriously and thought that wrestling should be, you know, portrayed as a sport participated in by real athletes. And I think that he had some great frustration when it became less of a sport and more of a show.
Dusty Rhodes.
Dusty was a very underrated broadcaster, very frustrated at times, I think, with the booking. Was a guy who could go too far and had to be reined in and operated best, I think, under certain controls. But he just lived for wrestling and just was one of those guys who had the gift of charisma and sometimes didn't quite know what to do with it. But Dusty was a very underrated broadcaster, as was Larry Zbyszko.
Larry Zbyszko, next on the list.
Yeah, he and Dusty could really do anything. You know, our producer Keith Mitchell would say, okay, we need 58 seconds to open the show. So I'd open the show, I'd toss to Dusty, I'd toss to Larry, and 58 seconds later I'd close it. I mean, they were just extraordinarily professional and really should be, you know, understood for the great broadcasters that they were, and in Larry's case he still is.
Tony Schiavone.
Tony was buffeted by a lot of wins within the company. He was an excellent producer. Sometimes didn't seem to love wrestling as much as he loved television. But, you know, he was able, I think, to deal with all the different personalities in the company in a way that I think he could probably write a book about.
Eric Bischoff.
Well, one time Terry Taylor told me about Eric that nobody ever came to him unless they wanted something. And I think Eric was, you know, he got what he asked for in this, that he wanted to run WCW. And he was thrust into something, and he didn't have a whole lot of administrative support. He was also seen as a guy coming from the outside as well. And I think that in many respects, he revolutionized wrestling.
Hulk Hogan.
I think with him is it was just, you know, such a roller coaster ride, and so much was on him And yet in wrestling, everybody is knocking you and trying to get your spot. So I think what happened is that, you know, he had a long ride and was on top for say, a couple of years. And then for some years after that, he kind of lived off his reputation. And then he got heated up WO. So he's the ultimate survivor. He's the ultimate worker in many respects.
Ric Flair.
Ric, again, you know, was, I think even he would acknowledge he probably hung on too long. But, you know, when they tried to switch the belt off him, nobody else could carry it like him. You know, I think, again, he probably acknowledged that his hard partying ways and hard drinking ways got in the way of having a normal and respectful and respectable life.
Roddy Piper.
I didn't know Roddy that well, but I do know that what he tried to do is tried to engage in normal relationships and not wrestling-based relationships. He was also very protective of pro wrestling, you know, realized what it had done for him, and, you know, had hung on for too long, but, you know, had achieved such stardom. I think what happens, like I say, with these performers and athletes is once you're at the mountaintop, you think you're always going to be there, and it's difficult when you're not.
Vince McMahon.
Well, you know, a genius in pro wrestling. I know that he's frustrated in that he probably wants to be known as more than, you know, just a pro wrestling promoter. But, you know, he certainly revolutionized the industry in ways that probably his father never would have approved of. But, like I always say about him, he is willing to risk everything. In almost every case, when it comes to pro wrestling, he's got an eye. Has he been around too long? Is he relying too much on you know, some trusted lieutenants who've been in the business for years and years? That may be possible, but, you know, ultimately, he's the guy who controls things, and he's fought his way in a nest of vipers, and he's won.
Sting
was a guy who I never felt like he loved pro wrestling. But I think now in his later years, in his late 50s, he's coming to appreciate more what he went through and appreciate the fans more. But, I he was always kind of just puzzled by the industry, but he was so good at it. And it's interesting. I think at some point he developed a passion for it, but it wasn't, I think, until later in his career. And he's quite a survivor as well.
Gene Okerlund.
Oh, who's that?
Gene Okerlund.
That was another guy who I think was a very underrated broadcaster, could really do just about anything, a guy who could be relied on, was serious when he needed to be, and was reliable. And I think that, you know, that's the key. That's the key with Vince, that's the key with Eric, is that, you know, will you show up? And Gene always showed up.
When they were riding high in the mid-1990s, what was that like?
Well, I think, that, you know, when you look back on it, you don't realize it. I mean, you kind of sort of know things are going well, but it's almost like the storm before the calm, as they say, which is the opposite of the calm before the storm, is, you know, you're in these big arenas and you're selling them out, and then the next month you're not. And so you don't know if it's a temporary lull or not. But, yeah, I mean, there's just times when wrestling really gets heated up and then times when you're just maintaining, and it's terrifying. I think it's probably like any relationship. You don't know if you're going to, you know, get back into the groove. And, you know, there were some people who were saying, look, WCW can't sustain. It can't go on this way. And people were saying, we've always been around. We always will be around. But, you know, in this case, they realized that, you know, it couldn't go on.
What did happen there? When did you see the writing on the wall?
Well, I didn't. I mean, until I was on the outside, because I think what happened is you had Vince, who had nowhere else to go. He'd burned his ships behind him, and he was willing to outwork anybody else. And then I think you had WCW, which was a tiny portion of a huge, you know, multinational conglomerate, was losing so much money. And the heads of the conglomerate couldn't see an end to it, the money losses, that is, and frankly didn't like pro wrestling. Whereas with Vince, it was his wife and mistress both. So I think it was passion that overcame, you know, just like the United States and Vietnam. You know, the Vietnamese were, they didn't have any place else to go, and they were going to fight to the death. And ultimately, the Vietnamese won, and in this case, ultimately, Vince McMahon won.
What is the, where is wrestling at now?
Well, it's at a lull. I don't think people realize that. Ratings are down, interest is down, it's boring, it's all sanded down, and, you know, dependent on people from the past. They're trying to move up young people, as wrestling always does, and I think that with MMA, you know, UFC, and a whole lot of other competition for eyeballs on a Monday and a Tuesday night, and on pay-per-view and on the network, I think probably they're doing what many entertainment groups do, is they're trying to super serve, you know, their super fans, and that might work, but I think wrestling in many respects is as unpopular as it ever has been. There was a time when, you know, you didn't have a whole lot of other competing sports interests. But now, I think I saw on Twitter last night that four or five of the major leagues, like baseball, football, NHL, soccer, something else, all had games last night or tonight. So there's a tremendous amount of competition, and I think the other thing is that many of the great personalities are either going into UFC or they're staying in football, and wrestling is at a crossroads, and sometimes, you know, you don't make it through the intersection.
When the story is written on WCW, how would you write it if you were writing the book?
Oh, missed opportunities. I mean, I think, you know, you've got McDonald's, you've also got Burger King and Wendy's, and that's good. Competition is good. It's a big country, it's a big world, and I think what you're seeing now is that New Japan, Ring of Honor, TNA, Impact Wrestling, if they do it right, they can service the pro wrestling fan who is not a fan of WWE. And so I think that WCW could have survived, and it's just it's sad. It's unfortunate. I mean, in radio and in television as well, if you're in radio and television and you get fired, you can go someplace else. You know, there's competition for good, talented broadcasters. More and more nowadays, if you are out of WWE or out of favor or whatever, you can get work in England. You can get work in Mexico. You can get work in Japan. And certainly in the independents, especially on the West Coast. But, you know, everybody wants to be there. And so Vince has kind of a stranglehold if you want to make the really, really, really big bucks. So it's just unfortunate, and it's bad for the boys. You know, there was a time in the 60s and 70s where there were thousands of pro wrestlers making good money because there was the territorial system. They don't have that now. Vince has won, and in many respects, the wrestlers have lost.
What, you told so many great stories on your Facebook page about Lance Russell. What is your favorite memory of the wrestling business?
Well, it's just, I think how enjoyable it is with the boys on the road, and how much they're underappreciated as athletes, and how much they are a system and they support one another. That was always enjoyable to see. You know, one guy would be up, the other guy would be down, and you know, you're trying to help, even though you're in competition with one another. It's really the understanding that it's almost a circus, you know, freak show in many respects, and that maybe the outside world doesn't like or respect or appreciate what you do, but the boys do, and they support one another. That was always glorious to me.
Who do you regard as the greatest of all time?
Oh, Bruno Sammartino, without a doubt, and I think that's kind of the sad thing is that, you know, as time goes on, people remember less and less of these greats. You know, we have baseball greats. We have, you know, A-Rod and everything. But what about Mickey Mantle and Willie Mays and Carl Yastrzemski? So I think that time goes by, but Bruno Sammartino was the heavyweight champion of the world for 4,040 days. You know, worked 6 or 7 nights a week for almost 20 years. Sold out arenas, not just throughout the Northeast, but throughout the country and throughout the world. So to me, there's just no, you know, I mean, it's just not even close.
100 years from now, whose name will they remember?
Well, I think we talk about that with Mount Rushmore. You know, you talk about it online. You talk about, you know, Bruno, Lou Fez, you know, in terms of notoriety, Ric Flair and Hulk Hogan. For some time, nobody was hotter than Steve Austin. I think The Rock, had he stayed in wrestling as well, Brock Lesnar has a chance at that. So those are kind of sort of the guys that, that really dominate. But it would be interesting to know 100 years ago, you know, 100 years from now, who people remember from this era.
It is, because it seems like if you talk to anybody about pro wrestling still today, if they know anything, they still know Hulk Hogan. Why do you think he resonated so much?
Well, he was on the cover of Sports Illustrated, and I think it was one of those times where the media said, oh, wrestling is hot. And it's no longer in the smoky arenas. Well, it hadn't been in the smoky arenas for 20 years. But, you know, the other thing is that MTV was getting hot in the mid-80s, and Vince McMahon, you know, hooked up with the, you know, the pop culture of the day. And then Hogan brilliantly, I think, kept his name in the public eye and was accessible, was a friendly interview, you know, would go on the television talk shows. And he was so big and so charismatic that he really made an impact in people's minds. And so people now in their 30s and 40s, they kind of grew up watching Hulk Hogan when they were kids. So it's tough to get him out of your mind.
Chris Cruz, this has been a lot of fun. I hope you can come back and do it again.
Yeah.
I've enjoyed it a lot.
Anytime. Thanks for thanks for having me.
Chris Cruz, here on WWGH Radio. We'll be back in about 10 minutes.
GH Radio, LP, Marion, Ohio. The Talking Place. For former coach of the Ohio State Buckeyes, Jim Tressel.
You know, it's interesting because everybody knows the story, obviously, of what happened there. But when that all was going down, because that's a rough period, that's a rough year. And, you know, as it comes out in Sports Illustrated that, you know, these emails were flying around on April 2nd and on December 9th, you publicly said you didn't know anything about it, and it all came down that way. Do you wish you had said, yes, I know about it on December 9th, or had reported it earlier?
Oh, gosh, I'm not sure that you have all the dots connected there. But if you ask, do I wish, throughout the course of the entire situation, that we would have made some different decisions, you know, without a doubt. But I'm not sure you have it exactly right.
What did I have incorrect? I want to be correct with this.
Oh, you know, that's for you to try to figure out, and you know, for you to know or not know. But you know, it came down the way it did.
To former Ohio State Marching Band director, John Waters.
From what I understand, the defamation lawsuit is a million-dollar lawsuit. I think that's what's been reported. Who knows if that's correct or not. But if they said, John, we made a mistake just like you said, come on back, would you drop the lawsuit?
You know, we'd have to consider all the, you know, all the pros and cons, because there's been a lot of water over the dam, so to speak. But you know, if they would say, "Yeah, come on back," you know, let's let cooler heads prevail. Absolutely, I would get rid of the lawsuit. You know, this was, the lawsuit was just a means by which we could open the conversation with the university. And, you know, as again I say, that all I have is my honor and my word and my reputation, and that's what I'm fighting for. And certainly in doing so, I'm fighting for the reputations of all those alums and students who've been, you know, misrepresented by this whole thing.
Being that this is a defamation lawsuit, obviously you feel they have defamed you in some way. When people see John Waters today, what do you think the interpretation is because of what went down?
You know, I think, and it's borne out every time I walk into the grocery store or you know, in public, you know, people say, you got the short end of the stick. You were the scapegoat, you know, person after person. Tells me that.
WWGH Radio 107.1 FM, Marion, Ohio.
Streaming live on the internet at www.wwgh1071.com. Find us on Facebook by searching WWGH Marion, Ohio 107.1 FM and clicking like for exclusive content.
The most haunted mountain in Ohio will come to life this fall. Are you brave enough to experience it? From the creative minds that bring you Tecumseh, hair-raising special effects, a terrifying zombie outbreak, the Horde. Doors of this mountain amphitheater and surrounding woods will open at dark, and the show will run until 11 p.m. every Friday and Saturday.